You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Anthony Horowitz returns to the show this week. He's the creator of one of the best TV shows ever, Foyle's War, and he has written and created lots of other great television shows like Midsummer Murders, and he's the author of the Alex Rider series for young adults, and I include myself in that category. He's written The Word is Murder, Magpie Murders, two great Sherlock Holmes novels, and a couple of years ago, he wrote a sequel to Ian Fleming's James Bond novel, Goldfinger. That book, Trigger Mortis, was the book I used to say was the best 007 story not written by Ian Fleming, but now I have a new favorite, and it's called Forever and a Day, and the author of that James Bond novel is also Anthony Horowitz. Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
What a lovely introduction, Gary. Thank you very much, and a pleasure to be talking to you again.
Well, your new book is set several years after World War II, which made me think of a great new series of mysteries that I want you to start writing when we get off the phone. And here's what it is. What about Samantha Stewart, your Foyle's War character? She's settled into post-war life, but her crime-solving proclivities rear their head and lead her back to a life of murder-solving.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because it was my idea at one stage to do another series with Honeysuckle and with that character, Sam Stewart. And I was going to set it, just so you know, in Brighton, in a hotel. And she'd be running a hotel, and all these strange characters of sort of the late 40s and early 50s would turn up to become residents. And yes, she'd get involved in all sorts of mysteries involved with their life. But I think that idea has sort of come and gone and isn't going to happen. I mean, there's so much to write and so little time to do it that I think we might have to just let that one go.
Well, I'm grief-stricken, but nevertheless.
You and many others. Look, I did Foyle's War, as you know, for 16 years, and I often say that was three times longer than the war itself. I think I did, you know, earn my stripes writing Foyle's War, and I was watching an episode the other night, funnily enough. I turned the television on, and there it was. And the first thing to say is I didn't really enjoy it, and the second was I'd completely forgotten anything about the story. I didn't even know who the murderer was. So it's sort of very much in the past now for me, but you know, very, still a big part of my life.
Well, actually, one of the things I loved about Foyle's War was after the series was over, I went back and watched the entire series again, and they were all new to me.
they do hold up, and the reason I think is that, you know, for every episode of Foyle's War that I wrote, not only did I read four or five quite large books to get the research, but I uncovered so many different stories. So it wasn't just a case of a murder is committed, who did it. There were all sorts of stories, two, three, four different stories about life on the sort of home front and during the war and immediately afterwards. And so it was a density of material, which is why the episodes do bear rewatching. You know, there are things that even I, the writer, have forgotten about, and I'm just delighted that the show is still around on television and still so readily available.
It's great. I love it. And congratulations
Thank
on
you.
Such a great work. Well, now, Trigger Mortis, your first James Bond thriller, it was kind of sandwiched neatly between Goldfinger and For Your Eyes Only. But there's not a lot of room. Every Ian Fleming James Bond novel, except for maybe The Spy Who Loved Me, in which James Bond is kind of has a cameo role, but every one of the great James Bond novels almost continues from the last one. So it's kind of hard to find a spot to write an original in the original timeline James Bond story, but you figured out a way to do it.
Well, it is absolutely true, but there is a strong timeline to the book. And incidentally, I start with the sort of decision, which other writers have disagreed with, that the Bond novels should really take place inside the world of Bond. That is to say, you know, in the sort of late 50s and early 60s. So, you know, William Boyd's and definitely Jeffrey Deaver's was much, much later. But the Bond novels were written between 1953 and 1966, and for me, that is when the books have to take place. Finding a slot is not easy, which is why I went back to the beginning, because if you decide that actually you're going to do a prequel to Casino Royale, then you have got quite a few years to fill. In fact, the book I wrote, Forever and a Day, starts, I think, about 3, maybe 4 months before Casino Royale and just looks at Bond as he becomes 007.
And it's so great when that becomes apparent, and I don't want to spoil any of the surprises in the book for anybody, but it's I just think you did a great job with it, and it was really fun to know that I was going to be watching the origin story of, and I say watching even though I'm reading it, the origin story of James Bond.
Well, you're very kind. For me, the pleasure of it was looking at a character arc. So this is not just a, you know, an adventure with a bad guy and action sequences and a resolution. It's also looking very much at sort of, I wouldn't call it completely an origin story, because Bond is pretty well formed before the book begins. He is, you know, as I say, earning his stripes as a 007 assassin. But he is already an experienced spy and an operator. But what I think was fun to write about was the way he is defined as how he loses something of his humanity, how he actually takes on board the sort of coldness and the hard-edged qualities that we know from the books, from that character. And I was able to sort of, you know, to intrude a little into Fleming's world and suggest what might have happened to make him as tough as he finally became.
Well, you know, one of the things I don't like about the James Bond movies is, and in fact about superhero movies and things like that in general, is they're always saving the world. Every single episode, they're saving the world. And you've kind of toned it back a little bit.
Well, the Fleming novels don't always have Bond saving the world. I mean, one of my favorites, Live and Let Die, it's just about, you know, smuggling gold, really. Casino Royale, the very first book in the Bond series, has a duel with one man, and the aim is to sort of bankrupt a criminal organization and take away its treasurer, Le Chiffre. There are stories. Moonraker has Drax trying to drop a bomb and destroy the whole of London, but actually a lot of the Bond novels are quite small in their sort of ambition. Set in Japan, You Only Live Twice. It's about just destroying Blofeld and his extraordinary garden of poisons. Scaramanga in Man with the Golden Gun is killing an assassin. So I think it's important that in the books, if one is writing books, and that is very different from writing the films, that you remember that the Bond's missions were often quite narrowly defined, and the villains weren't always sort of, you know, crazed madmen trying to take over or destroy the entire world.
Well, and you do that so well. And I know there are millions of people who have read the Ian Fleming novels, but there's jillions of people who have seen the James Bond movies. So you have to sort of have the movie Bond in your head at some point when you're reading a James Bond novel. And I wonder if that's true when you're writing it. Is there which James Bond do you picture?
Well, I sort of picture and hear, definitely hear, when I'm writing the dialogue, it has to be Sean Connery who is whispering in my ear as I sit at my desk writing it. I am a certain age, and therefore he was for me the first Bond, and although I think pretty much every Bond has brought something to the part, I'm not a huge George Lazenby fan, I'll be honest, but all the other Bonds, even Roger Moore, certainly in the early films, had a certain sort of, you know, attractiveness, I think, in the role. I think Daniel Craig, instead, is terrific. But for me, the first Bond, the original Bond, still remains somehow the only Bond. And I think, actually, that Connery's portrayal, I'm not sure if it was closest to what Ian Fleming had in mind. And, of course, famously, Ian Fleming had David Niven as his first casting choice. Can you imagine how the Bond franchise would have turned out if he'd had his way? But somehow, for me, maybe because the first three books were so close to the films, Goldfinger, Dr. No, from Russia with Love, the stories are very, very close. The action sequences, the world of Bond is very similar. So for me, Sean Connery has always been the most authentic Bond.
Oh, of course, I agree.
I had a feeling you might.
Well, so how much of Forever in a Day, it says right on the cover, with original material by Ian Fleming, so... In what way did Ian Fleming, how did you collaborate with the late Ian Fleming?
Oh, it's a wonderful thing to be able to say and to do, and I have to be honest with you and say that to have my name on the same cover as Ian Fleming is a great thrill, because, you know, I revere him as a writer and as a creator. You know, the modern spy novel begins with Bond. So how much of his material is in there? In Trigger Mortis there was quite a lot, but in This Says Less, and the reason is that at the end of the 50s, Ian Fleming wrote a series of treatments for a television series that was going to be made, I think, by MGM in America, but it never was made because the films came along before the TV could happen, so that was quietly shelved, and these stories were for a long time forgotten. Fleming did use a couple of them himself, I think in For Your Eyes Only. At least two of the stories in that collection were based on ideas he'd had for the TV show. However, about a few years ago, just before I wrote Trigger Mortis, the Ian Fleming estate discovered in a drawer five or six of these untold James Bond stories, and I was the first of the modern continuation writers to be given the opportunity of using one of those stories. So in Trigger Mortis, I took a story called Murder on Wheels, which is all about Grand Prix Formula One racing at the Nürburgring in Germany, and Bond getting involved in a very, very dangerous race, which was fantastic to write because, of course, motor racing doesn't appear, I think, in any of the books, and maybe only in one of the films quite briefly. So it was quite a new area to explore. For the second book, there were now fewer stories to choose from, and I picked a story called Russian Roulette, by coincidence, incidentally, the title of an Alex Rider novel as well, I hadn't known at the time. But anyway, that's a story which happens in the south of France, in which Bond is only sort of peripherally involved, really. It's not an action-adventure story. It's all set in a casino with a Russian captain losing a fortune on roulette and then threatening to blow up the casino. And I liked the story very much, and I thought I could fold it into this story because Reverend Day is set in the south of France. And so it appears as sort of a story that Bond tells in an early part of the book. When he meets the girl who is going to be his sort of sidekick and his love interest, he tells her this story about the Russian captain.
In your James Bond novels, and especially this one, there are a lot of things about Bond that we find out that we didn't know necessarily before. And are these things that you found by going through Ian Fleming with a fine-tooth comb and finding these clues that you could use, or are some of them your invention?
They're a mix, to be honest with you. Some of the sort of the bigger things, like why he drinks his martini shaken but not stirred and why he chose to smoke Marlboro cigarettes, are my interpretations, my inventions, but they're based on things that we know. We know what Bond likes to drink, and we know what brand of cigarettes he chooses. So all I'm doing is imagining reasons why he came to those choices, which in fact are very much dictated to him, or rather influenced by this woman, 16, who is the other half of the book and the love interest. I'm also combing through the books for clues, for little bits and pieces, for things that people might not have noticed. I've got two or three very good biographies of Ian Fleming and books about the books. So I'm well equipped to do this. And there are lots of Easter eggs buried inside the book, things that the real James Bond aficionado might notice and pick up on, but which, you know, will pass over most readers' eyes, which I do because I so love the world that if I can sort of find contact with something that only the real sort of, you know, aficionados know and recognize, it just makes me smile. So that's why I do it.
It makes me smile also. And I think where you and Ian Fleming veer is in your treatment of women. I mean, his women, although occasionally, well, they're always well written because it's Ian Fleming, but his women characters are not as strong or as dimensional as the women characters that you've written.
Well, it's a very nice, I take that as a compliment, but I'm not sure I entirely agree with it, to be honest with you. I think that the women in the Bond novels are always pretty strong. I mean, you know, Pussy Galore, who runs a gang and is part of Goldfinger's operation, or Tiffany Case, who has got an extraordinary story and is involved with drug smugglers, Gala Brand, an undercover policewoman. These are not sort of, passive characters, and they are very strong, and they give Bond a run for his money, and stand up to him to a certain extent. The difference, I think, is that when I write women, I'm writing for a more demanding audience, by which I mean a 21st century readership looking at a woman in a thriller of any sort, but particularly in a Bond novel, is going to have certain expectations, and they're going to have certain things that they are not going to be happy to see, and certain demands, actually, that the woman should be independent. independent and a 21st century woman and not a sex object and not just simply the Bond girl. I try to avoid even calling them that when I'm describing them, which does tie me in knots because there's not a better description I can think of than the Bond girl in a film or the Bond girl in a book. But there is something that objectifies and diminishes women in that description, so I do try to avoid it. But therefore, what I'm trying to say to you is that 16 in this book and Jeopardy Lane in Trigger Mortis are very carefully defined and very attuned to the sensibilities of a 21st century audience. And to that extent, they do differ from the Pussy Galore, the Tiffany Cases, etc., of the Ian Fleming novels. I don't think he was as exercised as I am about getting it right.
And because I guess we live in a more enlightened time, and that's a wonderful thing. But also, I think, you know, you're 16, for instance. I mean, she's a wonderful character, and she exists in as much as James Bond does. I mean, you don't feel like she's just a prop that's been inserted or a story device. She's got a biography, and I wonder how much you thought about her and how you created her.
Well, I thought of her and created her because of my knowledge of Foyle's War. When I was writing the later episodes of Foyle's War, I became fascinated with the Special Operations Executive, SOE, which is this underground army set up by Churchill to sort of fight behind the lines with any method that they could think of. And that, of course, is very much where Bond comes from, because Fleming himself was in naval intelligence and was connected to SOE. So that's sort of the origin of it, and to create a character who was once an SOE agent and who was tortured by the Germans and who felt betrayed after the war and then drifted into crime, it's really a Foyle's War type of story. I have to say that 16 benefits straight away from not having a sort of a Flemingish name. When you start with a character called Pussy Galore, you already have a woman who is not asking to be taken too seriously. And I think I'm not criticizing Fleming, because it was a different world and he was writing with a glint in his eye, which I don't have. But he did create women who were, how can I put this without being in any way negative, who were, well, I think I've already said it, who didn't need a second thought, who didn't need too much close examination, who simply were what they were going to be. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, in the 21st century, you cannot do that. If I created a character with a name like that, and if I said she was a lesbian from the age of 15 and had never been with a man, and then she meets Bond, and immediately, 1 minute or one page later, she's in bed with him, I think I would get into a lot of trouble. And so one of the aims I have in writing these books is to write books that people enjoy and which give pleasure, but also which don't cause me too much trouble on social media or in the press.
That's right. You don't want to get in trouble. That's good. Yeah.
Well, it's not necessarily good, actually, because I think the writers shouldn't feel constrained and hemmed in by sort of by political or by sociological thinking. But at the same time, these books are entertainments, and there is, you know, it would spoil it somehow if I wrote material that have a sort of, you know, the sort of casual racism or homophobia or the occasional hint of sort of condescension that one does sometimes get in the books. But then again, you always have to remind yourself that the books were written in the 50s when the world was a very different place.
Yes, but of course you're also writing Ian Fleming's character.
So trying to square the circle, you're trying to be absolutely true to Fleming, to his character, to his worldview, but at the same time you have to have a sensibility towards a modern audience who will be less forgiving.
The way you resolved Pussy Galore in Trigger Mortis was hilarious, but also, you know, kind of definitely had a reflection of the 21st century in it.
Yes, it's true. I don't think that what I did with Pussy Galore in Trigger Mortis was anything that Fleming would have had any argument with, because actually the women in the books are strong. I mean, Gala Brand rejects Bond and doesn't want to go to bed with him, and, you know, they part company at the end of the books. It's an interesting thing that one thinks of Bond as being this very sort of sexualized, even a cruel character. And it's certainly true that there is a very strong sex drive in the character. He wants women. He has a carnal desire for women. And he is, between the sheets, quite an aggressive character. But at the same time, what is interesting is that Bond always does treat his women with a certain amount of kindness and respect in the Fleming original books and certainly in mine. He is not somebody who abuses women or actually anybody, really. He is largely, I think, sort of socially acceptable. Not incidentally that Fleming would ever use those words, having spoken them to you in this discussion, but he is.
Well, I never had him on the show, sadly. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest is Anthony Horowitz. He's the New York Times best-selling author of Magpie Murders. He's also the creator of Foyle's War for British television, and his new book is a James Bond novel. It's called Forever and a Day. You talk about the kind of the glint in the eye of Ian Fleming and the kind of tongue-in-cheek quality of especially the Roger Moore films, but you try to steer away from that?
To an extent, yes. I mean, one has to remember that the books and the films are two very different things. You know, for example, there are no gadgets in the books. People seem to think that Bond, you know, all these gadgets that he has in the films, all the way to the invisible car or, you know, the magnetic zip opener or whatever it might be, are sort of somehow in the books. They're not. I mean, that's an addition that in my view, got slightly out of hand as the films went on, although incidentally, that Daniel Craig has wrote back very much on that, and there are far fewer now fancy gadgets and such. The double entendres as well, which sort of Connery sort of pulled off with a certain amount of panache, and I think there might be one or two in the books, but again, they got completely out of hand with Connery and with Roger Moore until you were getting really quite sort of, you know, groan-inducing puns and sort of sexual banter, which is not in the books. So when I'm writing the books, I love the films, but that's not my job to write a James Bond film. It's write a James Bond book, which is a more serious undertaking. I think it can have just as much action and as much adventure, and I try to think up stunts and pieces of sort of action that have never been done before. And in the new book, I'm very happy with at least two of the things that happened to Bond in the book, one on the ship when he's taken prisoner and one earlier on when he's tied up in a factory, are things that have never happened to the character and which I think Bond fans will certainly have their eyebrows shooting up when they come to those sections. But my job, as I say, is to stick very, very much in the world of the books and not to worry too much about the sort of what people might expect from just knowing the films.
Well, Anthony Horowitz, also you talk in your James Bond novel, your new one, about the license to kill and what that means and what kind of killer 007 is.
Yes, I think that is an interesting thing to write about. The original title of the book was going to be Towards 00, because that's what it was all about. And I'm almost sorry, in a way, that the estate preferred the slightly more romantic title, although Forever and a Day works for me as well. Towards 00 was the journey of the book. It's about a man who is trained to be a spy, but has still got his humanity, but he's now being turned into a number. He's not going to be James Bond anymore. He's going to be 007. So he becomes Zero, which is sort of a very nihilistic sort of journey. And I thought it was interesting that the woman that he meets has also lost her name, her identity, and has become 16, a number, which is her code name from the war. So that was what the book was about. It was what makes Bond able to kill and to walk away into the next adventure without any real remorse. I mean, at the end of Her Majesty's Secret Service, when his wife is killed, he sits there, and in the next book, he is still mourning for her, and he is still motivated to get revenge for her death. But by and large, the Bond of the novel tends to drift through his adventures on a slightly sort of glacial landscape, and he's not somebody who has great feeling or empathy, certainly not with the people he's killed. And I was interested in trying to work out how that had evolved, how it came to be.
Right, he even gets in trouble with his superiors for having a conscience in Forever and a Day.
Well, occasionally, yes. I mean, there's a moment at the beginning of Goldfinger where he's talking about the death of a man that he's had to kill, and he sort of thinks about, you know, what he has just done. But these are only brief moments that Fleming puts in. I mean, you know, he's very, very quickly moving on to the next kill, and is, I think that's part of the attraction of the character, actually. He doesn't sit there sort of, you know, tearing his hair out over what he's done or sort of browbeating in any way. He just gets on with the job. I mean, he is the Dark Knight. He is the Crusader. He is the man with no name. He's that character. You may be aware that in a book that Kingsley Amis wrote called The James Bond Dossier, he goes on about Bond being what he calls the Dark Knight, the ironic hero, the person who simply doesn't really develop or grow through what he does, but just does it with a sort of a coldness and a sort of definite quality that is unarguable. It's part of his strength, part of his mystery.
It makes me think a little bit of Patrick McGoohan and The Prisoner, which is sort of a sequel to Secret Agent Man, or Danger Man, as you call it.
I think Patrick McGoohan, who I think was even at one stage considered for the part of Bond, certainly did learn from the early Bond films and from the books in the creation of that character.
Yeah, the I am not a number, I'm a free man.
Precisely, yeah, that's exactly right. But, you know, it's a man, again, trying to find his own identity and everyone else trying to steal it from him. That's a series I was brought up on. I mean, you know, it's great, one of the greatest TV series of my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Me too. I met Patrick McGoohan one time. I said, "Can I just speak to you for a minute?" And he said, "One minute."
I can hear him doing it as you say that.
I said, "Well, I admire your work very much." But
it's very difficult when you meet these people. I mean, you know, I met Sean Connery as well, and you know, once you've spluttered out the words they've heard 1,000 times, you know, "I really love your work," you then wonder, what the hell do you say next? I always find it quite embarrassing. To sit next to Sean Connery, you know, to have lunch with him, which I did once, was sort of, for me, just too good to be true. I seem to remember getting quite blind drunk, actually. I couldn't cope with the excitement of being in the presence of the great man. But he was remarkable. I mean, you know, his presence, I'm seeing him in the past tense. He is, of course, very much alive, but he is... He's quite quiet now. I don't quite know where he is or what he's doing, but I met him, he must have been 70 or something, and or younger, maybe in his 60s, and he still had this incredible magnetism and strength. Wonderful actor, not just for Bond, but of course for so many other great films too.
Before and after Bond, of course.
Yes.
Well, are there other... You've done Sherlock Holmes and you've done James Bond. Are there other famous fictional characters that you'd like to take on?
No, I don't think so. I think that those two characters, Sherlock Holmes and James Bond, were a huge part of my childhood. They're the reason I became a writer. You know, when I was young, I loved reading the Conan Doyle novels. I loved going to the films. I mean, you know, Dr. No came out when I was 10, I think, and it was a huge experience to sort of share that adventure. And they were very much part of my growing up and part of my love of writing. So to write those books and to do continuation novels is a very easy yes for me. I mean, it's something I love doing. I'm not just available to do anybody else. I mean, you know, there are other characters around that one might think of, but I don't think I'd be interested in doing them. Also, I've just started, the second book has just come out in a series about a character called Daniel Hawthorne, who is my own creation, a detective solving quite complicated whodunits, and I'm planning to do a lot of books about him. So, I mean, the people ask me if I'll do a third James Bond, and the answer to that is that if I'm asked, I'd certainly consider it. You know, I had a huge blast writing Forever and a Day. I loved it. I really enjoyed doing the book, and I'm very happy about the response it's had, both here and in America. So I am very much open to the thought of doing a third one, but they haven't yet asked, so I don't know if it'll happen or not. But I don't think there's any other character I'd want to write about.
So no Saint novels, then?
I did, funnily enough, since you mentioned it, write a Saint for television years and years ago. I did a 2-hour Saint film. It wasn't hugely successful, as I recall. I'm not sure that it completely worked. Maybe the timing was wrong for Return of the Saint. But again, that's very much part of my childhood, the Saint, watching that on Sunday evenings on television. Even as you say the words or talk about, even as I talk about it with you, I can actually smell my mother's cooking. Isn't it? It's one of those sort of Proustian moments of 7 o'clock, Sunday evening. I'm very young, and my mother is cooking supper, and the Saint is on television.
I have, of course, many of the same memories with different kinds of shows. And even when I see the original paperbacks, the American paperbacks of the James Bond novels, it takes me back to a certain time in my life.
Well, I have all the original paperbacks here from sort of first and second editions from my childhood. They're in a very battered state now, but, you know, they are a big, big chunk of my early identity. And I also, for that matter, have quite a lot of Saint novels, too, which have sort of, you know, been battered and faded over the years. I'm not sure anybody reads The Saint anymore. Not that many people even read Bond.
Oh, a few years ago, before, quite a few years ago, before Trigger Mortis, I just decided I want to read them all again in order, and it was the most pleasurable experience.
Well, of course, every time I come to write a James Bond novel, the first thing I do is to sit down and read the entire canon. And you're right, that's part of the books are great for many reasons, and one of them is that actually when you return to them, they always yield something you didn't get the first time round. There's always something new to discover in them, a new pleasure, a new just something you may have forgotten. And so rereading them, as I have done probably four or five times over my life now, like great literature, they sort of hold up a mirror to who I am at that particular time.
They're a little bit shorter than the ones you write, but they're densely written.
But the Bond ones, his ones?
Yes.
They are. Some of them are short, some of them are longer. I mean, I forget which. From Russia with Love is quite a decent length. Others are shorter, but it's one of the difficulties I have, actually, is to get the length exactly right when I'm doing these modern ones. They have to be longer, I think, than the... Certainly Casino Royale is only about 60,000 words, and that's not long enough for a modern novel you're going to pick up at an airport, so you have to get to the 80-90. And that, because the books are fairly linear, and that's not a criticism of Fleming, it's just how they are. There's sort of a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's not like Ludlum with sort of lots of surprises and twists and turns, or Jeffrey Deaver with four or five different endings. They are what they are, and to sustain that for the correct number of pages is one of the challenges of writing the books. Forever and a Day does have one or two little surprises in it, which are not entirely Fleming-esque, because normally in a Fleming novel, you know who the bad guy is, you know what's going on. There aren't sort of surprises, really, along the way. You go along for the ride and enjoy the ride. You don't need to be baffled. But in Forever and a Day, there are a couple of mysteries that are sort of, or hopefully sort of surprise readers when they come to the end.
Because Anthony Horowitz wrote it. That's one of the things I love
about
it.
Well, maybe. You know, I am, after all, you began this conversation by talking about Foyle's War and sort of murder mystery and clues and surprises, twists and turns are what I specialize in. But nonetheless, my job is not to be Anthony Horowitz when I write these books. It is to try and be sort of the invisible voice that is just, you know, just trying to recreate Fleming, the great master.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Anthony Horowitz. He created Foyle's War for British television. He's written many novels, including the New York Times bestseller Magpie Murders, and his new book is a James Bond novel. It's called Forever and a Day. Anthony Horowitz, will you be writing more television in the near future?
Well, at the moment I'm adapting a great American novel, The Kay Mutiny, which I'm hoping will be a 8-part series. Sony are developing that with me, and Sony also have just bought the Alex Rider books, which I'm not developing myself, but which I'm involved with as a producer. Magpie Murders, which you mentioned in your introduction, which is a whodunit, which has been very successful in America and in England. I'm adapting that as well, trying to turn that into an 8-part TV series. It's not easy, I can tell you. It's such a complicated book, but it seems to be going quite well. And I'm writing a new Alex Rider novel, so I'm busy enough. I've got plenty on my desk to be getting on with.
Oh, I thought you were done with Alex Rider. I thought he was complete.
No. I brought Alex Rider back a couple of years ago for lots of reasons, and I wrote a book called Never Say Die, which had Alex sort of returning after a 5-year gap in my life anyway, and that went down very well, so I'm doing another one called Night Rise, Nightshade, which will be out in probably a couple of years' time.
Well, everybody will be looking forward to that. The Kay Mutiny, that's one of my favorite novels. Have you had a chance to talk with Herman Woke about it?
I have met him on two occasions. I saw him earlier this year. I was in Palm Springs in the just before the summer, and he is a remarkable man. I revere him. He is 103 years old. He still writes every single day. He is still incredibly active and switched on and intelligent, and I think he is a great American writer. I mean, one of the greatest.
No, I agree. And is he enthusiastic about your adaptation?
He knew Foyle's War, which helped with the introduction, and I explained to him when I first met him, which was about, it's taken a very long time, I'm afraid, to get to where I am now. These things often do. The underlying rights were owned by somebody else, and we had to come to all sorts of legal agreements about how we're going to proceed. So it's only just now that I've finally managed to start writing the adaptation. But when I spoke to him for the first time, I suggested to him that the books had never been given the adaptation they deserved. There is a fine film starring Humphrey Bogart, which I'm sure you know, but it's quite short. It's only an hour and a half or long, and this is a 700-page novel. And I thought that a 10-part or 8-part television series could really get into the material and give it the adaptation which it deserved, by which I mean an adaptation that would be completely true to the original. I said to him, every word, pretty much, of the dialogue is already there. It's in the book. All my job is to do is to edit and put it onto the screen in the order in which it appears, and that's what I'm doing.
I think it's a good match, because really, in a way, Foyle's War and Caine Mutiny and Winds of War and War and Remembrance, there's the same type of story that is taking people and put them in their, you know, through their lives, we learn the history that they lived through.
I think all of them are classic pieces of storytelling, that's right, and they have a sort of classic quality of the war. And it's an interesting question, which I often ask, which is, why did so few great novels come out of the Second World War? You'd think there'd be a number of great masterpieces written about the war, but that, in fact, they're few and far between. You've mentioned some of them, and you could say that Primo Levi wrote some great books based, you know, from the Second World War, and there have been one or two modern ones as well, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, for example. But those are, again, you can differentiate between Holocaust books and actual war books, and I think that The Caine Mutiny is one of the few really great novels to come out of the Second World War and to relate the experience of fighting it.
In addition to the Humphrey Bogart film, which I do love, there was a really interesting Robert Altman adaptation that he did for television. Have you ever seen that?
It's a two or three parter, which is largely based on the trial, I think. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, it was. It was just one film, The Caine Mutiny Court Martial. That
it was then. I think it was shown in England in two parts. So my memory might be playing false with me, but it was. That's absolutely correct. It was largely a courtroom drama. I can't even remember if they were flashbacks or not. But it wasn't the book, and it wasn't this, you know, the book starts at Fernald Hall in New York and Willie training to become a midshipman, etc. And it's his journey from that to becoming the last captain of the Caine. Whereas the Altman film was much more about Queeg and much more about, was he the sort of the madman and the coward, or was he actually a hero?
Have you done some casting on this?
Nowhere near that yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure looking forward to that. This will be great.
Well, if it happens, you know, it's these days getting television made is not as easy as it was 10 or 15 years ago. And the standard is incredibly high. The work that's being done on Netflix and Amazon and other S-boxes is incredible. But getting your things made is not easy. And we will see. This is an expensive project, and it's a Second World War project, and it's an old book, but I travel in hope, as I always do.
Well, this latest project from Anthony Horowitz is called Forever and a Day, and it is a new James Bond novel, and it's one of the best. Anthony Horowitz, thank you so much for talking to us again, and good luck with all of your things.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.